quickly followed my father out. But I'd taken what Arnold said very much to heart. The army was, officially, no longer my father's responsibility or duty. There was a good argument to be made that he should simply return to his plantation and pull the gate closed until the war was over. Instead, he was taking what seemed to me a large risk. For a man under suspicion of treason and neglect of duty to speak against the new general's plans for attacking the enemy. If this Frenchman must be set straight about the folly of marching in winter, it would be better for Arnold to do it. The hero of Saratoga would risk much less.
"Betsy's good with the soldiers," Papa had said. "Arnold likes her."
That was true, in a fashion. Arnold had taken a liking to me, not, as my mother might have hoped, for any feminine charm, but for the same reason that most soldiers liked me. Having spent most of my childhood tromping about the frontier, I carried myself with just enough boyishness to put them at ease. All the doctors complained that the 36-year-old Arnold was a fractious patient. But I'd once helped to distract him from his pain with a game of backgammon, and I suddenly felt certain that Papa had taken me along with him to help convince Arnold to attend what might be the most important dinner of the war. Because if we could not stop this doomed winter campaign, all the soldiers I'd helped stitch back together in autumn might be dead by spring. "Oh, but General Arnold," I rushed to say, "I'd be so disappointed to miss you at dinner. I haven't had a good game in ages, and you did promise me a rematch, sir." Arnold's scowl lifted only a bit, and I wished I knew what else I could say to convince him. I'd never learned the art of wrapping a lock of hair around my fingertip and flashing my eyes at a man. That was the provenance of my sisters. But emboldened by what I took for encouragement in Papa's eyes, I quite shamelessly added, "And my sister Peggy has been asking after you." The bachelor broke into a slow, toothy smile.
"Miss Peggy asked after me."
Of course, my sister Peggy asked after every handsome soldier, with the same interest and constancy she asked about ribbons, hats, and hair combs. But I nodded, and Arnold seemed intrigued.
"All right, then, I hate to disappoint a lady, but I fear Lafayette will not accept the invitation and will dine alone."
A happenstance I fretted about on the ride, which was mercifully short, given the difficulty Arnold's injury gave him in staying upon his mount, through our greatly disordered town. Before the war, winter in Albany had been a thing of enchantment. Pristine snow-covered hills sloped gently to a frozen river, where skaters had frolicked amongst sleds and sleighs. And up from the river stood a cluster of about 300 Gothic New Netherlander houses, their windows frosted and glistening icicles ornamenting the gables that faced the neatly kept streets. But our once bucolic paths were now trodden to slushy brown mud, with milk cows roaming the streets for want of a pasture, and we were desperate for everything. Meat, money, firewood, doctors. The circumstances were so dire that only a selfish or sadistic commander would force these soldiers to march. And I feared this young upstart Lafayette might be both. We'd scarcely arrived at the barracks when a commotion erupted from the direction of the river. I turned to see a procession of sleighs carrying soldiers, their white infantry uniforms embroidered with the fleur-de-lis of French heraldry. But at their head, wearing American buff and blue, rode a lanky young officer borne upon a majestic mount like a conquering Caesar. This must be Lafayette, I thought. And I didn't know whether to laugh or weep at the ridiculous sight of a baby-faced general who'd apparently traversed a wilderness in rain and snow, all while properly powdered and ornamented with gold braid and dainty lace. I confess that my first glimpse of him with one hand upon his hip, the other upon his sword and martial pose, was enough to convince me that he was exactly the young fool that Benedict Arnold supposed him to be. But when my father moved forward to make introductions, Lafayette seemed to know him already, and snapped off a very correct salute.
"Major General Schuyler."
The respectfulness softened me a little. When Lafayette dismounted and greeted General Arnold as well, Papa said,
"I present to you my second eldest daughter, Elizabeth."
Given the increasingly rigid revolutionary sentiment at the time, I was uncertain if I should curtsy to a nobleman like Lafayette, lest I be thought a secret Tory. Before I could decide, Lafayette took my hand and pressed upon it an audible kiss.
"Enchanté, Mademoiselle Schuyler. I am Marie-Joseph Paul-Yves Roche-Guibert du Mortier, the Marquis de Lafayette."
My eyes must have widened because Lafayette laughed and added,
"It is not my fault, all these names. I was baptized, like a Spaniard, with the name of every conceivable saint who might offer me protection on the battlefield, so that I might be invincible."
I could not help but smile at Lafayette's jest, though I disliked the word invincible. I'd known too many soldiers who thought themselves invincible in this war, and now found themselves moldering in graves. And if Papa couldn't talk sense to this Frenchman, he was going to put many more into the ground besides. Before Lafayette even inquired about quarters for his half-frozen men, or meeting the mayor, who was, no doubt, scurrying out of his house now at the surprise arrival, he asked my father, "Report to me, please, the conditions of the forces here at Albany and their readiness for a winter campaign." This was the news that we wished to broach slowly, over a good meal and in front of a warm fire, with Arnold vouching for all Papa had to say. But the Frenchman was already demanding a report, and looking to Papa to give it. Oh, how I cringed to see my father make a report to Lafayette, a now superior officer, one much his junior in age, and a foreigner at that. Still, the important thing was that the Frenchman heard the truth. Not enough gunpowder, muskets, or bullets. Too few provisions of every kind. Men without shoes, without coats, without medicines. It was an army that could scarcely defend the river, much less mount an invasion. Lafayette listened to all this with a half-lidded, nearly insolent gaze. It seemed to me that he didn't believe my father, or perhaps didn't wish to believe him. And rather than see Papa subjected to the further indignity of being dismissed, I was now eager to go. Pretending at a chill I didn't feel, I rubbed my hands together. "I'm quite cold, Papa." Knowing me to have the hardiest constitution of all his daughters, my father glanced at me with surprise, then back at Lafayette.
"I should very much like to discuss this further, sir. I extend my hospitality to you and your officers for dinner this evening. And with that, General Lafayette, I take my daughter and my leave."
But Lafayette's gaze skimmed over the encampment of miserable soldiers, and he actually dared to arrest my father's movement with a gloved hand tight upon his elbow.
"I cannot let you go, Schuyler, for I see now that I am betrayed."
Chapter 3.
"What is this hell of blunders, madness, and deception I find myself involved in?"
Lafayette shouted, having herded us into a large tent he commandeered in the field next to the barracks. The Frenchman removed his hat, revealing a prominent forehead, and drew my father and a hobbling Arnold toward the back, where they congregated around a table. Meanwhile, I was left to warm myself near a small camp stove, quite anxious about the Marquis's demeanor. Lafayette gesticulated wildly, shouting in French, a language I didn't know well, and imperfect English.
"It was promised me 3,000 troops fit to separate Canada from Great Britain and make her our 14th state. Instead, I find disarray."
This is not my father's fault, I thought. And even if our soldiers had been in perfect order and well-equipped, only a madman would think to assault Canada in winter. It had already been tried before and failed miserably. Even I knew that, and I was no soldier. I wasn't impressed or overawed by Lafayette's titles or wealth, or a ridiculously long list of names. He didn't know our country, our winters, or our river. He was too young and inexperienced to know better, and I wanted desperately to say so.
"Please don't be alarmed, Miss Schuyler.
a young officer whispered as he joined me near the stove, busying himself warming a pot of coffee.
General Lafayette, well, he can be most passionate in his moods.
The fellow attempting to soothe me was a tall, hulking soldier, with gray eyes and a dimple in his chin just like mine. He tilted his head in a quick bow beneath his frosty tricorn hat, then returned to the stove and courteously poured me a cup.
"My apologies, miss," he drawled. "It seems to be the dregs without sugar. In fact, I'm not even entirely sure it is coffee. But it's all we have."
I took the steaming tin cup warily as my father stood before a seething Lafayette, and Arnold gingerly lowered himself into a camp chair, extending his injured leg. My drink was horribly bitter, but if it was good enough for our soldiers, I would just have to choke it down. "I appreciate it just the same, Major..."
"Monroe," he whispered,
with the kind of shy, blushing smile that men usually gave my sisters, never me.
"Major James Monroe."
In spite of our situation, I found myself smiling a little too, and under my breath I said, "Have you served Lafayette long, Major Monroe?"
"Not precisely. I'm only here in my capacity as an aide to General Sterling, sent to deliver some confidential missives. It was a happy coincidence that he could send someone to accompany the French who knew the land, the language, and, well, Lafayette."
"How did you come to know our lands?"
"I served in the Hudson Highlands last year."
"And French?" I asked.
"My family is French Huguenot stock."
I sipped at the coffee and tried not to make a face. "And Lafayette?"
"I was with him when he took a bullet at the Battle of the Brandywine."
Monroe smiled at a memory that should have made him frown.
"He fell almost at my feet, but somehow got up again to lead his men to safety. I stayed with him that night while the doctor tended him. So I know Lafayette is somewhat irregular, but I think you'll find that he's brave and fair-minded."
Eyeing Lafayette, who was still gesticulating wildly at my father to articulate some point, I was not much reassured by Monroe's faith. A frigid wind gusted through the tent's flap, and when the major saw me shiver, this time without exaggeration, he removed his own coat and wrapped it around my shoulders. It was a small gesture, one I should have absolutely refused, since he'd already ridden so far in the cold, but one so gallant that I was charmed. It's strange now, after all these years, to think how easily I was won over by James Monroe's soft southern accent and courteous manner. Stranger still to realize that if I'd been told in that moment that one of the men in that tent would betray us, another would become my enemy, and a third would win my heart forever, I not only wouldn't have believed it, but would have guessed wrong as to which man on every score. Thumping his fist on the table, Lafayette shouted,
"This makes me wish I had never set foot in America or thought of an American war. All the continent knows where I am and what I am sent for, that I am to lead a great northern army. The world now has their eyes fixed on me. If I abort this campaign, men will have a right to laugh at me."
At this, my father's patience came to an end, and he delivered a stiff, cold defense.
"I will remind you, General Lafayette, it was not my decision to send you here. I have been against it from the start."
Lafayette tilted his head in apparent confusion.
"Oui, oui, but of course."
He waved a hand.
"That is why I am saying, my dear General Schuyler, I have read your reports. I have seen what you have been forced to endure. I wish to take into my confidence you and General Arnold, men loyal to Washington, men I can trust."
I was so surprised at Lafayette's words that I nearly spilled what remained in my cup. My father appeared equally surprised and unsure how to react.
"In coming here," Lafayette explained, "I go very slowly, sometimes pierced by rain, sometimes covered with snow, and not thinking many handsome thoughts about a projected incursion into Canada. I think now this is a scheme to have me out of the way."
Papa took a moment to recover. Benedict Arnold was quicker.
A scheme. This plan is too stupid to be anything else,
the Marquis insisted. I have seen such machinations in a royal court. It is an unmistakable pattern, no? When no one answered, Lafayette went on. It is a plot against Washington, or to replace him.
You cannot strike a powerful man until you first remove his allies.
This is why his rivals must discredit you, Schuyler. And it is why they send me to perish on some icy ledge.
Even with all the plotting against Papa, I was loath to believe anything so diabolical could have been envisioned. But Lafayette was a nobleman from the most sophisticated court in the world, and possibly wiser in the ways of backstabbing politics than any of us. So I believed him when he said, "Without Washington, there is nobody who could keep the army and the revolution for 6 months. We must give him a victory to bring back to the board of war. If not in Canada, then somewhere else."
Papa agreed, renewing his invitation to dinner, where a plan could be devised with the other officers. Lafayette accepted this invitation, but cautioned against speaking too freely, even with the others in his entourage, explaining why he'd taken us into the privacy of the tent in the first place. "I wish for the happiness and liberty of this country, but I now fear that she could be lost by her own sons. My friends, I fear a traitor amongst us."
You know Monroe to be a man of honor, a sensible man, and a soldier.
Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Hamilton to Lieutenant Colonel John Lawrence. We endured British officers in our house, but now we made ready to welcome the French. "I worried Mama wouldn't leave us time to dress," Peggy complained, throwing herself down upon the damasked canopied bed we shared. For our mother had not been warned to expect guests, much less a French general and 20 officers. If my father had a blind spot, it was his assumption that my mother was always ready to graciously entertain at a moment's notice, even when noticeably pregnant as she was now. Papa had unwittingly thrown her into a frenzy of preparation. With keys jingling at her hip, she marched from kitchen to larder to wash house and back again, issuing orders to the servants and to us until the very last moment. While I hurried to dress, Peggy propped herself up on her elbows to ask, "Are any of these French officers handsome, Betsy? Because if not, I'll wear my old flowered frock and leave my best brocaded gown for a better occasion." "Wear the brocade." Then, a little guiltily, I added, "And please sit next to Benedict Arnold tonight." Peggy groaned. "Why can't you? I'd rather sit near someone who isn't twice my age." I dared not meet her eyes, especially as I scarcely acknowledged to myself that I wished to sit beside Major Monroe. Slipping into dainty blue heels with bright rose ribbons, I confessed, "I told Arnold that you asked after him." "I only asked after his recovery," Peggy grumbled, rising from the bed so that Jenny could brush her curls up into a tall coiffure. "Well, don't say anything to him about his slow recovery or his leg," I told her, because Peggy was the sort who needed to be told such things, sometimes more than once. "Arnold is very sensitive." Peggy merely shrugged in answer. Fastening the blue paste earbobs, I was reminded again of my older sister. "We've still had no letter from Angelica in Boston." Sighing, Peggy nodded. "I suppose someday we'll become accustomed to not having word from her." I didn't think so. I could never add up all the ways in which our painful separation imposed its scars on me. A part of me felt guilty for feeling this way when I had yet another sister at my side, but I sometimes thought I could never be happy without Angelica's protectiveness, and the way she'd made me feel a needed part of her schemes. For as long as I could remember, we'd had a bond based on sharing confidences and sisterly advice. But my relationship with Peggy had never run as deep. I had fun with Peggy, and she made me laugh. But without Angelica, I was left to figure out who I was, as a woman and a sister. And since her elopement,
I'd begun to think of myself differently.
No longer the middle sister trying to mimic and falling short. Now, as the eldest daughter in the household, I felt a greater responsibility and confidence. So I pushed away the notion that the dazzling jewelry didn't suit me and made for my father's table. Downstairs, beneath the chandelier and gilded portraits of my ancestors, Lafayette supped at one end of the glittering table next to my father. My mother presided at the other end, near Baron DeKalb. Peggy squeezed between General Arnold and Major Monroe, which led to the happy circumstance of a space next to the latter for me. It was surprisingly restorative to have friendly soldiers again in our home, and I listened intently for anything else Lafayette might reveal either about a plot against Washington or a suspected traitor amongst us. My attentions were so riveted on the Frenchman, in fact, that Peggy felt the need to twit me. I thought perhaps a certain British Lieutenant André had already captured your affection, she whispered. Or have you finally settled your cap for a French nobleman? I forced down a swallow to keep from choking on my buttered bread and embarrassment. If she'd been closer, I'd have kicked her beneath the table. As Major Monroe was sitting between us, he only stopped shoveling food into his mouth long enough to interject,
"Alas, the Marquis already has a wife. I'm afraid you ladies will have to aim a little lower."
Peggy laughed. "To you?" Reluctantly slowing his efforts to wolf down what might have been the first good meal he'd had in ages, Monroe blushed.
"That would be more than a little lower. When it comes to marriage prospects, from the Marquis to me is a drop from a cliff."
I smiled at the Major's self-deprecating nature. Meanwhile, Peggy mused, "Lafayette is so young to be a general."
"A year older than me,"
Monroe replied loyally.
"And in any case, I think we're better off under rising young officers than we are under Granny Gates."
Granny Gates? It was a highly insubordinate thing for a junior officer to say of a general. We should have upbraided Monroe for it. And yet I don't think he could have found any words that would have sounded sweeter to the daughters of Philip Schuyler. I liked Monroe. I liked him very much. And that was even before Prince served our dessert course, when I noticed Monroe wincing as he rubbed at his shoulder. "Are you injured, Major?" I asked.
"I was. It's all healed up now."
"Whatever happened to you?" Peggy batted her eyelashes at him. Monroe flushed.
"I was foolish enough to get myself shot at the Battle of Trenton."
We'd read newspaper accounts of that battle, and Peggy all but squealed. "Are you the one who sees the cannon shouting, 'Victory or death?'" With endearing humility, Monroe swirled a silver fork upon Mama's floral china plate.
"Well, I don't remember what I shouted. All I heard was the whiz of a ball as it grazed my chest."
Now this was entirely too much humility. "Grazed?" I exclaimed. "Why, I read that it hit an artery and blood bubbled up like a geyser through your uniform. Or wasn't that you?" Peggy's pallor turned a little sickly green at my vivid description, and Monroe's eyebrow shot up, as if he couldn't fathom that a lady might say such a thing at the dinner table. He stammered,
That was me."
I started to explain that I took a keen interest in medicine, but was saved from myself when Peggy raised a glass, as if it were proper for her to propose a toast. "To the hero of Trenton!" I started to raise my glass, but in catching the darkening, jealous gaze of Benedict Arnold, I quickly added, "And the hero of Saratoga." Mama frowned at our antics from her end of the table. But from the other, Lafayette raised his glass, too.
"While we remember our worthy brothers-in-arms, I toast Mrs. General Schuyler, our gracious hostess, whose husband must soon be acquitted of these ridiculous charges made by stupid men who, without knowing a single word about war, undertake to judge."
A more temperate man might have hedged his support, but Lafayette threw in for my father with his whole heart.
and it thrilled me even as I looked round the table for those who might disagree. My father nodded gratefully, as if humbled. Then Lafayette stood and addressed me and Peggy.
Ladies, I am sad to abandon you now so I may hear wise advice from your papa and General Arnold.
With that, the servants cleared the plates, and the most trusted senior officers closeted themselves away. Monroe was too junior to join them, so while Mama entertained the Frenchman, we took Monroe into the blue parlor, where Peggy kept refilling his wine glass, and I bested him in a furious game of backgammon.
"I declare, Miss Schuyler,"
Monroe drawled in defeat, his accent stronger the more wine he drank,
"you take advantage, but I suppose I ought not to feel unmanned by a game of chance. Who taught you to play?"
Still holding the dice, I boasted, "Dr. Franklin taught me when he visited to treat with the Six Nations. Besides, backgammon is only partly a game of chance. It's also a game of math and perseverance. You're forced to learn patterns and choose the best move, even if it is only a choice between evils." Monroe dropped his gaze.
"Is it in the nature of all New York belles to deprive a man of even his fig leaf?"
I blushed, because I knew what a fig leaf was meant to cover. Because Monroe was the first gentleman, since Lieutenant Andre had visited, who seemed to prefer talking to me than to flirting with my sisters, and because I believed he was calling me a belle. Pretending as if this were not a rare compliment, I asked, "Are we New York belles so very trying to your Virginian sensibilities, Major Monroe?" He had the temerity to pause in thinking about it.
"Any trial is compensated for how you ladies keep me from missing home. After all, if a man is so stupidly sensible of a belle's charms as to devote his attention to an absent ideal, she cannot receive a higher insult."
"I shall not be insulted if you pine for home." To prove it, I asked, "What do you miss most about your Virginia?" I thought he'd mention his family, or farmland, or horses, or really just about anything other than what he actually said.
"My mammy's waffles, hot from the fire, slathered in melting butter."
I laughed, expecting that Peggy would laugh too, when I realized that she'd somehow grown bored and left us alone. She'd later tell me that she thought Monroe a bit too unpolished and simple for her tastes, but he seemed to me as a still part of the river, where it sometimes runs deepest. And he confirmed that impression when he confided,
"As much as I miss home, I am curious about the world, and wish to see as much of it as I can."
"We're kindred spirits, then. As a girl, I used to gaze westward at the horizon with a strange yearning, wondering how far the land went, imagining what it would be like to see and explore everything." He eyed me with curiosity.
"That seems an unusual yearning for a belle."
I flushed, much less pleased to be described as a belle now. "Not for one who has come of age at the frontier."
"Albany is hardly the frontier," he said with an indulgent smile. "At least, not compared to where I grew up."
"I'm speaking of Saratoga," I argued. "Before the war, that's where I felt most at home." Our home at Saratoga had always seemed to be a mysterious gateway to a world I could scarcely fathom and longed to explore. I'd climb rocks and wade in creeks and come back late with wildflowers in my hair, all brown from the sun. And Papa would tease that perhaps when my mother left me hanging in a cradle board from that tree, I'd been switched with an Indian child. When I told Monroe as much, he chuckled.
"And were you switched? You can tell me. I'll always keep your secrets."
He leaned closer, and for the first time in my life, a flutter of real romantic interest stirred within my breast. Monroe was a patriot, a war hero even, and possibility sparked between us. "Perhaps I was switched," I teased. But I'd rather you tell me a secret.
Oh? He asked, swirling the claret in his glass.
Do you think there's really a conspiracy against General Washington?
I know it,
Monroe answered, draining his wine glass like a man who preferred beer.
It was within General Sterling's little family that we discovered the evidence.
Rapt, I leaned closer. Who is the villain?
It's a cabal of villains. Inspector General Conway is involved for certain, and...
Monroe trailed off there, as if aware that perhaps he'd said more than he ought to have. But I pressed him. Gates. Is it Gates? Monroe peered over his shoulder, then met my gaze and nodded slowly.
Gates is trying to replace Washington as commander-in-chief of the military.
Outrageous. Gates is a scheming bumbler, I hissed, though I knew my father would never approve my saying so. But it was true. Gates would have lost even the Battle of Saratoga were it not for Benedict Arnold's heroics. But as indignant as I was at the idea that the New England darling would ever be commander-in-chief, that wasn't as awful as my other fear. Is there anyone close enough to Washington to do him harm? I asked. Because 2 years before, there had been a plot to assassinate him, and the culprit had been amongst his own bodyguards. And given that Gates had already used rumors of my father's treachery to oust him from command, and seemed willing to condemn Lafayette and the whole Northern Army to an icy death in Canada, what else might he stoop to in clawing his way to the top?
No chance of that, Monroe assured me. Not since Colonel Hamilton joined Washington's family as aide-de-camp. My good friend Hamilton is too cunning to let an assassin get close again. He would sniff it out at a mile.
I knew the name Hamilton already, of course. We'd all learned about Alexander Hamilton's military exploits in the gazettes we read each morning at the breakfast table. In fact, when my sisters and I were away visiting our Livingston relations, Hamilton had even stopped to see my father, briefly, in passing through Albany. But my clearest memory of ever hearing Hamilton's name was from the mouth of James Monroe, and spoken so fondly, too. It hurts now to remember how fondly.
It's the politicking in Congress and the Board of War that will do General Washington in,
Monroe said with more shrewdness than I might have expected.
Lafayette is right. We need to give Washington a win to bring back to Congress, even a symbolic one, or Gates will get command and there goes the war.
At length, as if to fight off the effects of a large meal and the lateness of the hour, Monroe stood and shook himself like a giant hound caught in the rein. And when I saw him rub again at his shoulder, I asked, "Should it still hurt you?"
"Don't know," he replied. "The bullet lodged in my shoulder just likes to remind me of its presence sometimes."
"I know a little nursing, if you should like me to—"
"Oh, no, miss," Monroe said, nearly tripping over my mother's lace-covered sideboard table in his hurry to back away, as if I'd suggested something very untoward.
I'd only meant to offer some of the precious willow bark powder that Mama kept as a remedy for pain. But Monroe almost seemed to think I meant to undress him.
"I wouldn't hazard being shot again, by your father this time."
Virginians are preposterous creatures, I thought for the first, but not the last time. Thankfully, the farce was brought to an end because Lafayette emerged from my father's study, and the officers made ready to take their leave. I was sorry to see them go, especially because I did not wish to leave Major Monroe with the impression I was a coquette. But when Lafayette came into the parlor to retrieve Monroe and say farewell, he noticed a wampum belt upon a table with Papa's outgoing parcels and letters, and tilted his head in apparent curiosity.
"Mademoiselle Schuyler, your papa says you have accompanied him to treaty conventions with the Six Nations. Can you tell me of this?"
Flattered that Lafayette wished for me to explain it, I answered, "It's a wampum belt. They served as a form of money once."
at least until my Dutch ancestors began manufacturing wampum in such quantity as to make it worthless as currency. Taken by themselves, the beads are merely white, purple, and black shells, sanded and drilled. But string them together, and they can tell a story, seal a treaty, or serve as a badge of authority. If you knew the patterns and the symbols, and I did, having learned them at a very young age from the native women who bartered with Mama at the back door of our Saratoga house, and with whose daughters I sometimes played in their nearby village.
"What message does this belt convey?"
Lafayette asked, peering at me from the corner of his eye. "It's an invitation." For though Papa was no longer in command of an army, he'd long served as Indian Commissioner, an important position he still held. My father arranged to have this wampum belt and others to be delivered through Iroquois to call for a meeting of the Iroquois Confederacy. The young Marquis seemed enthralled.
"Do you know why?"
We could never emphasize enough to outsiders that the Iroquois were not to be confused with other Indians. The people of the Longhouse were a democratic nation, and a powerful one, represented by statesmen who had skillfully played the British and the French against one another for decades. Because if we can convince the Six Nations to remain neutral, we'll deprive the British of their Indian guides and war bands. Lafayette's smile turned sly.
"May I?"
he asked, and when I nodded, he took up the belt to inspect it.
"These symbols, do you know what they mean?"
"Well, that," I said, pointing. "That is the tree of the Onondaga Nation, the keepers of the central fire, the custodians of records.
And this,"
Lafayette traced an open rectangle. "The Oneida," I said, overcome by the sudden impression that he was testing me like a schoolmaster, and had been doing so since the start of the conversation. "People of the Standing Stone. They're friendly to us."
"Your father has invited me to go with him to Johnstown for a conference with the Six Nations."
I saw my father's strategy at once, and I warmed with hope. Despite the Six Nations' vow to remain neutral, many of them had sided and fought with the British against us. We couldn't hope to get them to join us instead, but in light of our victory at Saratoga, there might now be an opportunity to make them honor their vow, if they would come to a meeting. General Gates had turned a deaf ear when Papa urged him to pursue a diplomatic course with the Iroquois. There was no glory in that for Gates, but thus far, the Marquis had proved to be as fair-minded as Major Monroe claimed. Maybe we could convince him. Iroquois neutrality could change everything. It could help win the war, and it might be just the victory Washington needed. "I hope you'll accept Papa's invitation to go," I said, "because if Lafayette presided over the treaty convention, the Six Nations might attend for that reason alone. After all, Lafayette had one thing Papa did not. He had the King of France behind him."
"Indeed I will go, mademoiselle," he said. "But given your knowledge, perhaps you should go too?"
"Yes," I said, before my mother could even lift a disapproving brow. Before even I could discern whether or not it was an invitation made in earnest or jest. I knew only that it was the moment, in all my restlessness, I had pined for. And I was sure my father would understand that restless longing. "Oh, yes, I intend to go." Angelica was not the only Schuyler daughter, after all, who could forge her own path. Chapter 4. We were headed into Iroquois. The snows were still so deep we were obliged to go by horse-drawn sleigh, my father leading the way beneath gnarled tree branches that bowed encased in glistening ice. Our slow pace frustrated the hard-charging Lafayette, who was eager to rendezvous with the Iroquois Confederacy. And I was nearly as impatient, for so much was at stake, not just the Indians' neutrality but the war itself. I'd once asked myself how a daughter could make a difference. Now I might have the opportunity. though I'd attended Indian conferences before. Never one like this, in the company of soldiers as if I, too, were a warrior in a fight I believed in. Bundled in a fur cloak, I rode nestled beside Major Monroe, who I suspected had been tasked to watch over me.
"Are you warm enough, Miss Schuyler?"
It was the fourth time he'd asked. "I am, thank you, Major. Are you always so attentive?" I didn't even have to look at him to know he was blushing.
"I try to be attentive to ladies who are so delicate."
This made me laugh because he said it through chattering teeth. "I dare say the weather seems to go harder on Virginians. Perhaps I should be the one to offer you my coat this time?" I regretted pricking at his pride because he scolded,
"Ladies of Virginia would not go out in this weather, nor would their fathers condone their presence on such an adventure."
I couldn't tell if Monroe was jesting or if he truly disapproved. My father had never discouraged my sisters and I from taking an active part in his affairs. Before she eloped, Angelica had dutifully sent Papa military intelligence reports from Albany, and I had sometimes accompanied him on his travels. I would later learn that the daughters of New Netherlanders expected to enjoy a bit more independence than other American women. But at the time, it seemed only natural. Why shouldn't he condone it? I have lived alongside the Six Nations all my life. When that didn't seem to convince him, I added, "Besides, when I was 13, I was adopted by the Iroquois." At that last remark, Monroe's shy smile disappeared. Beneath his dark wavy hair, his gray eyes went wide, and he looked so startled that I feared he might fall out of the sleigh.
"Whatever can you mean? You're telling fibbery."
"You insult me, sir," I cried like a man ready to challenge him to a duel. Laughing, I explained. "It's true. I remember well how all the chiefs, clan mothers, and greatest warriors, row after row, stood silently around an open space where green grass gleamed." Major Monroe now seemed enraptured, so I continued. "I dressed in white and they in the splendor of war paint, and I held tight onto my father's hand when, with much pomp and ceremony, the chieftains put their hands upon my head, commented on my black eyes, and gave me an Indian name. I pronounced the name in their language. It means one of us." Though Monroe could not seem to decide if he ought to be awed or horrified, Lafayette, riding beside the sleigh, turned to marvel.
"Then, mademoiselle, you know not only the symbols but the language of the Iroquois League?"
"Some," I nodded, for I'd been raised in a home where Dutch, English, and Mohawk were all spoken. Lafayette rubbed at his reddened nose.
"Ah, we have the company of a pretty lady and a blessing of her knowledge. Pity, Monroe, you must leave us soon."
Monroe had come with us as far as he could. Having discharged his duties in Albany, he felt bound to return to winter headquarters at Valley Forge. But as we reached the road where he would take his leave of us, Monroe didn't seem to want to go. It was hard to credit that such a big, strong soldier could be so shy, but as he prepared to leave, Monroe reddened to the tips of his ears and stammered,
Do you think your father would find it permissible, Miss Schuyler, for me to write to you?"
Was it such an improper thing for Virginians to correspond with a lady friend without her father's permission? Or did he mean to imply the beginnings of a courtship? I wasn't sure, but I am more apt now to think it was merely an attempt at gallantry, owing to the antiquated peculiarities of James Monroe. Or maybe to his southern charm. Perhaps they were one and the same. In any case, what I said was, "Well, what if I were to say you have my permission, sir, and that's all you need?" He gawped a bit at my brashness, and the fact that I'd taken up the reins of the sleigh as if I meant to drive it, which I had intended, until I realized he might think it unladylike. It seemed to me as if we New Yorkers were too aristocratic for the New Englanders and too bold for the Virginians, which made me wonder how we'd all get along together if we weren't forced into it by our war with the king. I parted with Monroe affectionately, though not nearly as affectionately as Lafayette did. The Frenchman hugged Monroe and kissed him upon both cheeks again and again, until the major finally seemed like a squirming cat eager to get away. Then we continued westward, onto Johnstown. When the Marquis first said that the world's eyes were upon him, it seemed a self-important boast, but he was already known, or at least known of, by the chieftains. And because he was a Frenchman, we were very well received where the Iroquois had gathered for the conference along the banks of the Mohawk River. Hair streaked with feathers, their ears cut open, jewels dangling from their noses, their tattoos and painted designs visible beneath the beaded skins they wore. The old man smoked pipes and talked about politics, and so did the women. This did not give Lafayette pause.
If you could see the salons in Paris, the women are the same, even in my own family, perhaps especially the women of my family.
With that, the Frenchman waded into the crowds and showered them with little gifts, mirrors, rum, brandy, and shining gold coins, louis d'or. And the Iroquois took to him, just as we were beginning to take to him. It was the same generosity he'd shown our soldiers in Albany. There, and with his own personal funds, he'd bought food, armaments, and clothing for the men. I would later learn that Lafayette spent more than $12,000, an even more outrageous sum then than it is now. He'd been able to do for our soldiers what Congress could not. He put shirts on their backs, shoes on their feet, and beef in their bellies. And when he began drilling soldiers, they actually obeyed him, calling him the soldier's friend. As the daughter of Philip Schuyler, I might have resentfully said it was because he bought their loyalty. But in truth, I admired the sincerity with which the Frenchman approached his dealings. No one could ever accuse the Marquis of being unpretentious, but his enthusiasm and optimism were infectious, even amongst the Six Nations. And I might have been more sure of the success of our mission were it not for the fact that the most distinguished Mohawk had not responded to the messengers with the wampum belts. No Seneca, next to no Cayuga, only 100 Onondaga. Disappointed and alarmed, I said to my father, "They won't even meet with us." Papa squeezed my hand. "There are nearly 800, Betsy. It'll be enough for word to get to the others." Finally, the ceremony commenced on the common. The Indians arranged themselves in a circle by nation and clan, sitting on the ground upon blankets and furs, men on one side, women on the other, chairs left for the commissioners, and for me. In the center, a large pot of meat broth boiled away over a fire, and as a pledge of sincerity, three elderly chiefs delivered to Papa and Lafayette a belt of wampum much more intricate than any I'd seen before, curiously worked with porcupine quills and handsomely painted. When it was my father's turn to speak, he didn't dissemble. He merely explained that the King of England was an ocean away and would abandon his Iroquois allies when the Americans won this war, that if the Six Nations didn't bury their war axe now, they'd soon find themselves facing a new American nation that would treat them as enemies. I worried that he would press them too hard, but those who sat nearest to the fire, the Oneida and Tuscarora, my father praised for maintaining the neutrality they'd once promised, and he pledged our friendship and protection. That was all he was permitted to say for the time being. These tawny-skinned people of the Longhouse abided by strict rules and rituals, and it was now time to dance. An Oneida clan mother named Two Kettles Together approached me, bells in hand.
"Are you not one of us?"
She was one of those who had adopted me into the Six Nations, and grinning that she'd remembered me after all these years, I readily fastened the bells on my ankles. "I am so happy to see you," I said, introducing her to Lafayette as a warrior in her own right, who had fought at Oriskany. Armed with two pistols, she'd reloaded her husband's weapons when he, wounded, couldn't do it for himself.
Like Jeanne d'Arc, Lafayette exclaimed in warm greeting.
A French warrior woman. I have an ancestor who fought beside her. Perhaps one day you should fight beside me.
If you are lucky, Two Kettles Together said with a shrewd little smile, before taking my hand and pulling me into the dance, where the Indians united by hands and jumped round the pot that hung over the fire, animated by the music of a small drum. One of the chiefs likewise took Lafayette by the hand and danced him round the circle too. Another blackened Papa's face with grease from a pot. Whether this was a trick to excite a laugh or a part of their actual national ceremony, I didn't know. But my very dignified father did not like it. And yet Lafayette insisted he must also have his face greased. Apparently charmed by his boisterous participation, the Iroquois adopted Lafayette too, with a new name. Cayula, Fearsome Horseman. I knew this was partly because they liked him and mostly because he was a representative of France. Too many of our fellow Americans dismissed the sons of the forest as simple savages. But we who lived so near to the Six Nations knew better. They were not to be trifled with or tricked. Other Indians lived in fear and dread of them. What the Six Nations wanted was a balance of power in the region. If they couldn't have it with the King of England, they'd seek it with the King of France, and with the Marquis de Lafayette as the conduit. And because I was hopeful that peace between our peoples could be achieved, I stayed late with the women, who danced, ate soup, and drank rum. I was quiet, listening to those who didn't realize I understood their language, enough to overhear something not meant for my ears. Two Onondaga women complained of going through the motions of this treaty convention. It was a sham, they said, meant only to raise our hopes. I pretended at fascination with the dance, softly clapping my hands. Only when it would draw no notice did I make ready to return to Papa's side and warn him. But when Two Kettles Together rose to walk with me, I feared she knew that I understood. And for a fleeting moment, I felt the gravest danger of my life. A feeling that lessened only a little when she whispered, "You now know that the Onondaga cannot be trusted. Tell your company to be on its guard. I've heard talk of a spy in the neighborhood who has eyes on your father, and especially your Frenchman." Sweat beaded upon my nape, as I remembered at least two prior occasions when the British sent agents to kidnap or assassinate my father. With damp palms, I squinted in the dim light of the fire, daring a glance at the faces around it, suspicious and mistrustful of everyone. I suppose Papa would be flattered to know he was, even stripped of command, still in their sights. But the Marquis was the more valuable prize.
"Do they mean to kill him?"
"I don't know the plan," she said, "only that the British have put a target on his back, and the arrow man is near."
"Mademoiselle, you are a most excellent patriot,"
Lafayette said when I returned to the safety of Johnston Hall, where I reported everything. To my surprise, the Frenchman seemed sanguine.
"It is good you learn of all this in secret, while all eyes were upon your father and me. You have been an essential asset to the cause."
It was flattery, French flattery at that, and I wanted to believe it was true. But I was crestfallen at the certain failure of our mission, and worried, too.
"The British aren't the only ones who have spies," Papa said to reassure me. "I can say with confidence that the man they've sent to make trouble is Major Carleton, the nephew of the Canadian governor. I suspected he was in the area incognito to suborn the Indians who are friendlier to us. Now we have better reason to think so."
I bit my lower lip, thinking it quite a risk for such a prominent British officer and gentleman to take, even if he was not an assassin or kidnapper. If he was caught in disguise, he could be hanged as a spy. And perhaps that's what Lafayette had in mind when he said,
"I shall offer a reward of 50 guineas to anyone who will bring him to me alive."
Then, almost as an afterthought, he added, "And since there are Indians who are friendly to us, I will offer them, and only them, trading posts and protection."
"But might not attempts to divide them further provoke those who are against us, ending our hopes to get the Six Nations to remain neutral?" I dared to ask.
Lafayette nodded. "If we cannot get neutrality, perhaps we can get something better."
At the next day's council, the Indians were in an uproar, all pretense of accord abandoned. For the magnificent chieftain, Grasshopper of the Oneida, rose to address the warrior class.
"By refusing to make peace, you sow the seeds of your own destruction. You have forced us all to terrible choices. Now, instead of being strong as six arrows all together that cannot be broken, we are in splinters."
Six arrows. The Seneca, Cayuga, Onondaga, Mohawk, Oneida, and Tuscarora. Together, they'd formed a confederacy older than Great Britain. The chief turned to my father.
"The Oneida and Tuscarora will not remain neutral."
Amidst murmurs and shouts, I nearly gasped as Grasshopper raised his voice over the fray.
"We say to our brethren, the Americans, that we, too, are a free people with absolute notions of liberty, and we will join your cause and pledge to be buried in the same graves with you, or to share in the fruits of your victories and peace."
The impact of the moment resounded in my bones. I wasn't alone. Lafayette didn't hide his tears as he rose.
"This man possesses the dignity of a Roman senator. The philosopher Rousseau speaks truly of man's nobility in his state of nature. For here, as much as any place in America, has taught me that we are, all of us, and have right to be free."
That very day, the Oneida promised to send warriors to join Washington's army at Valley Forge, and a clan mother with white corn to help feed the starving soldiers, and teach them how to prepare it so they wouldn't get sick from eating it dry. We had meant to secure neutrality. Instead, we came away with allies, warriors, and food. Though Papa was wary, Lafayette thought it a triumph. Perhaps not as glorious as victory upon a battlefield, but a triumph that would redound to both Lafayette's and Washington's credit and help win the war. As for me, I was so stunned by what had taken place that I allowed myself a sip of rum that night at the campfire when Lafayette offered it to me. And then I coughed on it, which brought a guffaw from the Frenchman.
"Do you dislike the taste of rum, Mademoiselle Schuyler?"
My eyes watered as I struggled to answer. He laughed again.
"You and I can speak candidly, now that we are kin. Nous sommes une famille, comme frère et sœur."
"Pardon?" I asked hoarsely.
"We are sister and brother, yes. Having been adopted by the Indians, we are both savages, you and me."
Lafayette said this word as if it were more glorious than his noble title. But then, as if fearing I didn't understand, he added,
"The Iroquois forests are peopled by my friends. To me, the despots of Europe are the true savages."
He leaned in with a grin.
"After we leave this place, come to Washington's headquarters at Valley Forge with me."
I blinked. "Whatever for?"
"Because you shall have a bevy of admirers. I would even count myself amongst them."
Fearing that the Frenchman, despite being married, meant to press an improper flirtation upon me, I'm afraid I was quite tart. I do not think, even with your encouragement, that my father would consent for me to become a camp follower. Lafayette threw up his hands.
"Mon Dieu, I suggest nothing dishonorable. Men like me, the wilds remind us that when stripped of luxuries and titles, we are all the same but for our honor."
With that, Lafayette's chin gestured in the direction of my father.
"And weary men of honor need to be reminded of what they fight for. Come with me to Washington's camp, ma chère Mademoiselle Schuyler. You and your father, who may be safer in a military camp than facing spies and treachery on his own."
I was touched by Lafayette's concern for my father. And just then,
Across the campfire, I spied two kettles together, who went where she pleased, wore what she pleased, did what she pleased, and fought when she pleased. I knew that if it were my choice, I would go with Lafayette, but it was not my choice. You forget the matter of Papa's court.